BP in the hot seat.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, in for Bill Radke. Welcome to the Morning Open, when we take a look at business and the economy as Wall Street starts its trading day. More bad news for British oil giant BP. We'll get to that in just a minute, but first, let's do the numbers. Markets are up a bit this morning after tanking late yesterday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 0.25% to 10,047. The Nasdaq up just a hair to 2223. The S&P 500 up nearly 0.3% to 1073. BP stock is up this morning after falling 13% yesterday. The U.S. Justice Department has launched a criminal probe into BP. Here to talk oil with us is Richard DeKayser, president of Woodley Park Research in Washington, D.C. He joins us live. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Stacey.
So, Richard, we have this new criminal investigation, but BP's stock seems to be stabilizing. Do you see it dropping more in coming weeks?
No, I don't. And I'll tell you, we took a big hit, both the criminal investigation as well as the failed top kill attempt to contain the spill. But it seems to me like all the bad news is out now. The total share price drop has been 36% or about $58 billion. Analysts are putting the top end estimate for damages related to the spill at $35 to $40 billion. So I think that they've pretty much taken all the damage share price wise that this has to deal to them.
Exxon got beat up in a similar way after the Valdez oil spill, but the company rebounded. It's now the biggest company in the U.S. How did they pull that off? And is there a playbook here for BP to follow?
Well, I think there are some lessons. Basically, they covered the costs, and these did include in the Exxon case as well, criminal charges. But unfortunately, aside from dealing directly with the spill itself, perhaps the only message to take away is control of the message. That is to say, CEO Hayward could surely be doing a better job of describing the outcome of this situation, and he's consistently been on the mild side of reality, and that only creates a greater political backlash.
Richard DeKayser is president of Woodley Park Research. Thank you, Richard.
My pleasure.
For more now on BP, we turn to our man in London, Stephen Beard. Good morning, Stephen.
Hello, Stacey.
Stephen, what is Hayward expected to say?
He's quoted in the Daily Telegraph this morning saying that he's going to tell shareholders that concern about BP's balance sheet has been overstated. He says the crisis is financially manageable. BP's got a lot of cash, enough to pay investors their dividend in full, and have as much as $8 billion left over.
Well, BP's stock price is down again this morning, that on top of the 13% drop we saw yesterday. There seems to be at least some question out there about BP's future.
There certainly is. I mean, there is so much uncertainty and talk about a criminal investigation and also, of course, talk about the U.S. possibly forcing the company into receivership and getting control over BP's assets hasn't helped. The underlying fear here is that BP may have permanently damaged its future prospects in the U.S., where it currently derives 25% of its energy.
What about Tony Hayward himself? Is there any danger of him losing his job?
Well, his prospects do look pretty grim. Nick McGregor is an oil analyst with brokers Redmayne Bentley. He says Hayward's days as chief executive are surely numbered.
At the end of all this, once it's finished, I do think it will probably be the case that this draws a line under Tony Hayward's tenure. I think his ability to run BP going forward has been seriously compromised by this.
He says Hayward has not exactly endeared himself to the American people with some of his observations. At one point, he described the spill as very, very modest. And on Sunday, he said, "No one wants this thing over more than I do. I'd like my life back."
Stephen Beard in London. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Stacey.
This morning, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, or FCIC, is grilling ratings agencies about their role in the financial crisis and why they gave Gold Star ratings to bundles of mortgage loans that were nearly worthless. Eric Kulchinski was an analyst for Moody's. He said the firm didn't have the manpower to do its job.
We did not have the time to do any meaningful research in all of the emerging credit issues. My own attempts to stay on top of the increasingly troubled market were chided by my manager. She told me I spent too much time reading research.
Gary Witt, former managing director for Moody's, says the ratings agency's business model is part of the problem.
The last reason that large rating agencies like Moody's are too popular as scapegoats is the glaring conflict of interest at the heart of their business model. they are paid by the issuers they rate. Managing this conflict requires that Moody's balance competing interests of two groups, the investors in Moody's shares and the investors in the debt that Moody's rates.
Warren Buffett will also be speaking later today. He owns a big stake in Moody's. We turn now to Marketplace's Brett Neely to take a look at what ratings agencies could look like in the future.
The big agencies got into trouble when they labeled risky investments AAA. But investors had no other place to turn. The government protected those agencies from competition, and their ratings were considered free speech, so they couldn't be sued.
It's like if the government said that, you know, agencies of the government had to use Amazon to decide what textbook to use or something like that.
Mike Konzel is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute and follows financial reform. He says the legislation before Congress would have the government assign agencies to rate corporate debt and strip the agencies of their protection.
Taking that out of the law will then let private agents kind of determine whether or not there's value in them.
But there are other problems the bills won't be able to fix, says Robert Lighton at the Brookings Institution.
Well, it has been a traditional problem where rating agency people have viewed their next job as working at the equivalent of Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley.
Analysts at the agencies still may want to keep banks happy in order to swing a better paying job. But Lighton says after this crisis, working at a ratings agency could mean a resume downgrade.
As Rodney Dangerfield would say, they don't get respect, and I'm not sure it's going to be possible for them to earn their respect back.
With that respect gone, Lighton says many investment funds have simply stopped paying attention to the ratings agencies and are doing the same work in-house. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Four prime ministers in 4 years. That's the political situation in Japan. The latest leader quit today amid controversy over the U.S. military presence in the country, among other issues. But the world's second largest economy is ready for a new leader, someone who can perk up the lumbering Japan Inc. Our Asia correspondent Scott Tong reports.
Tokyo stocks fell 1% today, but many analysts said Prime Minister Yukio Hatoyama's resignation was not the driving force. In fact, stock analyst Stephen Church at Japan Invest thinks the market reacted favorably to the news, i.e., the drama's over.
I think there has been relief that the uncertainty has been removed.
Prime Minister Hatoyama led the opposition Democratic Party of Japan into office last summer, pledging to kickstart one of the hardest-hit economies in the global recession. But Church says the prime minister lacked the political oomph to take on Tokyo's powerful bureaucracy. Task number one for the next guy? Tackling Japanese debt. As a percentage of the economy, it's more than 250%, far worse than the U.S. debt load.
The issue is dealing with that very high public debt by increasing the total tax burden.
The Japanese economy has been going sideways for the better part of two decades, and later this year it's expected to be surpassed by China as the world's second largest economy after the U.S. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Detroit is 140 square miles, but a third of that is vacant. Many city officials, entrepreneurs, and grassroots activists see that as an opportunity to turn the city into the world's foremost laboratory for urban agriculture. But the idea of turning a major part of Detroit's landscape into farmland is getting a lukewarm reception. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick reports.
In the shadow of the former General Motors World Headquarters is a neighborhood that's dotted by vacant land. But one corner lot is getting a makeover, with help from a few gardening enthusiasts, including singer-songwriter Taja Seville. She heads a nonprofit group called Urban Farming. They want to put gardens like this in hundreds of other spots around the city.
We're going to be planting collards and tomatoes and peppers and bush beans and all kinds of wonderful stuff. It's going to be a great garden.
But it's not just grassroots groups that want in on the urban agriculture movement. Entrepreneurs also see fresh food as a potential growth sector in a city with few decent grocery stores. One company wants to build the world's largest urban farm here. Mike Score is president of Hans Farms. He says Detroit started as a farming community, and there's no reason the cash-strapped city shouldn't make agriculture part of its economy again. Score says Hans Farms has big visions of turning up to 10,000 city acres into farmland.
We have to get enough land put together for our farm to be financially viable.
But Score says they'll have to start small, with as little as 50 acres. He says getting a hold of land is difficult because the city lacks a master land use plan.
The city's in a difficult position because they don't want to give away land that or sell land that would be strategically important to them down the road. On the other hand, they realize they can't hold on to foreclosed properties forever.
Detroit must also revamp its zoning laws to accommodate commercial farms. City Planning Director Al Fields, who was at the urban farming groundbreaking, says that will take time.
The City Planning Commission and our team is working together to craft the best rules and guidelines for that.
But the city appears to be moving cautiously to welcome big agriculture. For many, the idea of turning large swaths of the Motor City into farmland isn't easy to swallow. In Detroit, I'm Sarah Swick for Marketplace. Production is starting up again this week at Honda's Chinese plants. That after most of the workers at a key supplier agreed to end a strike that had shut the plants in exchange for big wage increases. Our own Elisa Roth joins us live from New York to talk about this. Good morning, Elisa.
Good morning.
Elisa, we don't usually hear about striking workers in China. Does this mean Chinese workers are getting more power?
It's certainly a sign that they're demanding more power, and it seems like they're starting to get it. For one thing, there's a labor shortage in some parts of China, particularly in the coastal regions where these Honda plants and a lot of other car makers are based. The other thing is these are relatively skilled workers we're talking about, so it wouldn't be that easy to replace them.
Should we start expecting more strikes like this one? And what would that mean?
I talked to Dan Rosen. He's a consultant on the Chinese economy, and he says we've been seeing strikes here and there for the last couple of years, but that's really just the beginning.
So this is going to be a story for the next 10 years, how much pressure we're going to see in Chinese wages and how that increase in Chinese wages is going to show up on the shelves of Walmart.
He says it'll be less of an issue for things like clothes because those are pretty easy to make. But where we'll really see it is things like electronics. And that goes back to what I was saying before, that the skilled workers really have the upper hand right now.
Elisa, I'm wondering if this fits into the story we've also been hearing in the past few days, the factory in China where the iPhone is made and there have been about a dozen suicides. What is going on there?
Well, the factory owners continue to say that it's not a sweatshop. They just gave the workers there 30% pay raises. Again, this is a skilled labor issue. The people who work there are trained and they have skills. And so apart from the moral concerns about treating workers well, companies like Apple and HP that use those production facilities would have a really hard time finding replacements.
Elisa Roth in New York. Thanks, Elisa.
You're welcome.
And finally, how many gigs does it take to run Gmail? Well, it's time to learn. AT&T has announced it's going to phase out unlimited usage data plans. Customers will choose from different data contracts, tiered depending on how many gigabytes they plan to use. AT&T says it will help users figure that out, but I'm guessing most of us will find out when we get a $700 phone bill. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, and this is the Marketplace Morning Report.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.